Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. There's more at allbook-books.com, the website. So this is a fascinating book. I'm not going to try to convey the whole thing, the gist, like I sometimes do, but just give some notes, an overview. Some other books I'm reading are slow reads that I read a few pages and I got to put it down for a while. This book, I just went right through the whole thing. One of those, I couldn't put it down, but not in the sense of a novel, because it's intense. As the title suggests, The Psychology of Totalitarianism by Matthias Desmet. He is recognized as the world's leading expert on the theory of mass formation as it applies to the COVID-19 pandemic. He is a professor of clinical psychology at Ghent University, Belgium, and a practicing psychoanalytic psychotherapist. His work has been widely discussed in the media recently, especially with relating to the COVID and why masses of people went along with news. Although, as I observed and others observed from years of reading news articles, that there was literally, I saw no definitive answers, and yet the system was based on definitive answers. Forced mandates. I know of a young high school guy who said that applying to colleges and one of his friends is not vaxxed, so could only apply to colleges in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. So they're like mandating things when things have not been proven. Masks or no masks, vaccine side effects, just all kinds of stuff. I won't get into all that because I want to focus on the book. So the book, my interpretation of The Psychology of Totalitarianism is why, and what he calls mass formation or mass formation psychosis, why do masses of people go along with totalitarian thinking and regimes? Now, we tend to point the finger at, say, somebody like a Hitler and say that, you know, he was the madman, but people don't talk as much about, but why did he sway so many of the German people? And then yet another angle is, as a recent article at Global Research, Sleeping with the Third Reich, America's Unspoken Alliance with Nazi Germany Against the Soviet Union. There's more to the story. John, and this is quoting from somewhere, John D. Rockefeller Jr. owned a controlling interest in the Standard Oil Corporation, but the next largest stockholder was the German chemical company IG Farben, through which the firm sold $20 million worth of gasoline and new lubricants to the Nazis. And the Venezuelan branch of that company sent 13,000 tons of crude oil to Germany each month. So without that oil, without John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil, a U.S. company, sending oil to the Nazis, there would not have been the Nazis per se doing what they did. So in that case, it seems like just greed or, you know, mask or control freaking, but in the sense of the book, it's more having to do with the psychology behind it. Some of the highlights are what he highlights as the industrialization, the mechanistic ideology. Mechanization. I think of that with, you know, how I've said before, like, you know, you can track a package. You order a package and it'll tell you every town it tracks to, but yet there's people starving and they can't ship food or get clean water. So that efficiency that, you know, makes the shipping companies, global corporations and megabucks is a mechanistic ideology. Rational materialism, technologicization and atomization. How we're all kind of, you know, people are, everybody's got their phone, everybody's got their this and that. We're atomized instead of communified psychology going on. And these are the conditions that make people ripe for the totalitarian state. So thus the, nowadays with the cell phones and the social media, the way messages get put across them, by people being hooked to these mechanistic ideologies, they are ripe for the messages that get broadcast and following them without questioning where they're coming from. And historically, Desmet cites the Enlightenment Age, which which spawns some free thinking, yet also he highlights that as a precursor to the mechanistic ideology. There was also a split in science way back. There was, when science was trying to actually find out and do things and what's going on and how to help, you know, how to apply that, but then it became hijacked, and so nowadays everything is trust the science, but nobody's discussing whether that science is valid or not, or if you disagree, you get banned. Doctors that disagreed with the COVID narrative, their articles and videos and their jobs were banned from social media and from jobs. Here's Desmet in the Science and Ideology. However, from the beginning, the tree of science also sprouted a branch in another direction, the exact opposite direction of that original scientific practice. Based on the great achievements of science, some people tipped from open-mindedness to belief. For them, science became ideology. It was mainly the mechanistic, materialistic branch, the so-called hard sciences, that most enraptured us. Simple in its principles, the laws of mechanics, specific in its object, the tangible, visible world, and awe-inspiring in its practical applicability, from the steam engine to television and the atomic bomb and the internet, this science has everything to seduce human beings. With this branch of science, man conquers space. So that whole sense of conquering, that was touched on in when I talked about the book The Religion of Technology. From the Enlightenment forward, mechanistic thinking provided the grand narrative in Western civilization. And he talks about how the science became a turning point after religious ideology had ruled much of the world for many years. And in a way, it's still a combo. As Lebon, L-E-B-O-N, noted in 1895, the effect of mass formation is identical to hypnosis. Both hypnosis and mass formation are largely caused by a voice, in the literal sense, through the physical vibrating qualities of the voice. Totalitarian leaders are well aware of this, sometimes intuitively, sometimes consciously. Totalitarian systems have always been maintained primarily by systematic indoctrination and propaganda injected into the population on a daily basis via mass media. Without mass media, it is not possible to generate such long-lasting mass formation as that which gave rise to Stalinism and Nazism. This way, the population is literally kept on the vibrational frequency of the voice of totalitarian leaders. Totalitarian systems typically make it nearly impossible for people to gather in larger groups, and they strive to sever all social and family ties and replace them with the only allowable bond, the one between the individual and the totalitarian system, that is, the collective. In the Soviet Union, this process was implemented in a much more systematic way than in Nazi Germany. This is why the process of totalitarization in the Soviet Union persisted in a more far-reaching way. And in this country, what people call democracy, the removal of native children and the forced boarding schools, the cutting of their hair, they're forcing them to learn to forget their sacred traditional languages. That is exactly totalitarian, along these definitions of strive to sever all social and family ties and replace them with the only allowable bond, the one between the individual and the totalitarian system. So he talks about this also in the context of the coronavirus, and some things that were not discussed much. Victims of corona measures due to famine, domestic violence, poverty, economical damage, deterioration of general health and immunity, violation of democratic fundamental rights, infringement of privacy, and psychological damage. And he gets into the differences between mass formation and classical hypnosis. So it goes into depth about that. And then at times he waxes philosophical. However, if you are able to feel affinity with the wheel and get to sense the deeper rhythms present in the variety of movements, then you experience the timeless creative harmony that is present underneath the variety of superficial movements, and the wheel becomes an appeasing phenomenon. Some kind of reference to a wheel, but I won't get into that. Perhaps a person's greatest task to discover the timeless principles of life in and through all the complexity of existence. The better we can sense those principles, the more we feel that we start to understand some of the essence of life and that we are connected with the majestic ordering principle that speaks to us from across the universe. And the more we stick to our principles, even if it seems to our own detriment in the short term, the more real those principles become and the more we develop as human beings, a real sense of existence and fortitude. Being too opportunistic and relinquishing our principles because a smart analysis of a situation suggests it might be advantageous also leads to a loss of individuality and experiences of meaninglessness. If one focuses too much on the superficial appearances of life and loses touch with the underlying principles and figures, life will increasingly be experienced as a meaningless chaos. So that is much of the state of the world nowadays, the levels of anxiety and existential crisis, a sense of meaningless, promoted in much part by the media and their fear-mongering and a lack of bonding and communities and a lack of, you know, strengthening the bonding ties, community ties, and with the timeless, the unseen, the earth energies. Why do people go out for walks in nature? Because they want to get re-energized, but it's to stand with that kind of energy while dealing with these things is the bigger challenge. Well, he mentions one root issue of the psychology behind all this is a lack of social bonding, anxiety, and fear. So he says that when there's a cause, that's one of the key things mentioned, that when there's a chance to kind of rally around a cause, that people who feel alone or have not resolved inwardly their own anxieties, they join the group so as to feel a sense of belonging and strength. And that is, but that gives a false sense of community and false sense of solidarity because it's not an intimate connection with people. It is a rallying around a cause, almost like, you know, you can enjoy a baseball game or a concert, but the sense of group participation there is it's false in the sense that it's not a genuine intimate experience. It's a temporal intimate experience. But as soon as you leave that stadium or that concert hall, where are the feelings? Where are the bonds? So that's, you know, you relay that to some cause where people rallied around some of the COVID measures and were pointing the finger at those who didn't want to get vaccinated instead of allowing them their freedom of choice and bodily autonomy. That's where he talks about, Desmond talks about anxiety linked to an object that becomes the hook. So if there's anxiety unresolved, totalitarianism is the ultimate attempt to rid ourselves of this uncertainty by withdrawing into a pseudo-scientific certainty and merciless logic by trying to reduce symbols to signs and by trying to annihilate all variety in cultural expression. Totalitarianism obliterates such diversity in every possible way. The systemized and industrialized transportation, exploitation, and murder of population groups in labor and extermination camps are historical examples indelibly engraved in our minds. So there he's talking about the uncertainty principle that to be uncertain, I've mentioned that book before by Alan Watts, The Wisdom of Insecurity, by a level of uncertainty is a normal part of everyday life. But yet, when the system and the totalitarian system does not allow one to healthily deal with one's anxieties and build confidence, so to speak, then the other hooks become the false certainty of everyday routine and ritual, but it becomes regimented. The logic of a totalitarian system is in constant flux and typically becomes ever more absurd. The raison d'etre of a totalitarian system consists of, among others, channeling anxiety, which is why it must constantly identify new objects of anxiety. That's bingo for the mass media right there. Which is why it must constantly identify new objects of anxiety. That's the mass media system that is mind control, going from the war of terror and then to, you know, financial collapse and on to COVID and then the Ukraine and Russia. There's always some level, not to diminish the seriousness of some, you know, some of those, but the way the media presents it is always presenting an object of anxiety. Now here's perhaps one of the key lines in the book. When the system is no longer able to link anxiety to an object, it loses its raison d'etre. When the system is no longer able to link anxiety to an object, it loses its raison d'etre. Now, that reminded me of a John Trudell poem where he says, from the native perspective, we know it is our destiny to starve the beast. And that's what he's saying. That's what Desmond is saying there. When the system is no longer able to link anxiety to an object, it loses its raison d'etre. When the masses of people would stop projecting, if that's the right psychological word, their anxiety and getting hooked on the object that the system presents, then the system will have nothing to feed off of. Then the system, that is one of the ways that the system, and perhaps the way that the system will collapse. Because you're not going to, as John Trudell said, you're not going to outfight it. The system has the weapons. The system has the guns. They have the technology. You cannot outfight them. And he also gets into the quantum physics versus just brain and science and, quote, objectivity. Also mentions, like, one of the best things people can do is continue to speak up and tell the truth. The real volte-face and revolution that society has to face is to shake off rhetoric and resolutely turn to truth as a guiding principle. The author Foucault Foucault distinguished four forms of truth-telling: prophecy, wisdom, techne, and parrhesia, speaking boldly. So without getting into all that, but that is one of his calls for, no matter how big or small, truth-telling and community, again, no matter how big or small. To the degree that we can connect with what is outside ourselves, we are able to transcend our own boundaries, and our own world of experience gets expanded to an existence that extends endlessly in time and space. Through resonance with the greater plane, we participate in the timelessness of the universe, like a reed rustling in the eternal air of life. So I think this is a book is a call to question the system, and to question the hooks, and to be wary of rhetoric and smooth talk and the voice, and how we get hooked on in the media and such like, and how we can unhook and starve the beast. So this was published in 2022 by Chelsea Green Publishing. P.S. I wanted to add the chapters. Read the contents page with the chapters, because that gives a flavor of the book. Part 1, Science and its Psychological Effects. Science and Ideology, Science and its Practical Applications, The Artificial Society, The Immeasurable Universe, which is I am in parentheses, because he's talking about that contrast between the measurable and the immeasurable universe, The Desire for a Master. That's interesting in the psychological realm of why people get swayed by, for example, totalitarian charismatic leaders, so-called leaders, The Desire for a Master. Part 2, Mass Formation and Totalitarianism, The Rise of the Masses, The Leaders of the Masses, Conspiracy and Ideology. Part 3, Beyond the Mechanistic Worldview, The Dead versus the Living Universe, Matter and Spirit, Science and Truth. So again, that chapter, The Dead versus the Living Universe, reminds me about original peoples, native languages, and for example, as I've learned, the Lakota language, the traditional language, is all verbs, no nouns. It's all action. So part of why it's challenging for many people to see and experience the earth as a living being, a rock as a living being, and on, is that our language has numbed us. The English language, for one, has numbed us into sort of dead nouns, referring to things as objects and things that have no life to them when they do have life. And in that chapter, Desmond writes, we could, of course, delve deeper into the findings of quantum mechanics to further relativize the idea of a mechanistic universe, but the phenomena of which quantum mechanics speaks are situated in a dimension that most people will never have access to. But that is where the little that I know of the native languages is they do touch on that. So that's a whole other topic. And I do want to wrap up with a note that, while as mentioned at the beginning of the tendency to point the finger at the madman, I think in a cosmic worldly perspective, not enough people are not examining themselves. In other words, face your inner Hitler, which is could be a synonym for the ego or the hungry ghost that is never satisfied, the ego that seeks to dominate and control situations and other people. Have you ever just realized, wait a second, I'm trying to control this whole situation? Is that not a little flavor of inner Hitler? So if we all do our work, along with stepping away from and starving the outer beast, we also need to wrestle with and deal with the potential inner beast that sometimes rears its ugly head and makes people insane, do insane things, become control freaks and egomaniacs and what have not. So if one looks beyond all that to the egalitarian view is one of the best ways to rapidly diminish any ego behaviors and reactions, to realize that in truth, me, you, anyone is really just one small part of the huge, huge picture. I am no more important than a grain of sand, yet the grain of sand and I are important. So there's a Zen cone to wrap it up with. Thank you for listening. Be well.